When the Royal Society of London in the 1660s began to organize its scientific links with European intellectuals, Spain did not feature. The puzzle, which still eludes any easy explanation, is why the most universal society of the globe was unable, after centuries of imperial experience, to discourse on equal terms with other European nations that shared the same background. Parenthetically, this is the same period in which the papacy found Galileo guilty of heresy and placed him under house arrest for 7 years until he recanted for propounding the Copernican argument that the earth revolved around the sun. David Landes, in The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, points out that in 1600, philosopher Giordano Bruno had been burned in Rome for much the same offense, by which the church proclaimed its intentions of taking science and imagination in hand and leashing them to Rome. Spain was even more dogmatic and medieval. That could not be said of the discovery-minded Netherlands. In the 17th century, their scientific and technological knowledge had impressed all Europe, and even in the early 18th century, the Dutch Enlightenment was the instructor of Europe in microscopic science, botany, anatomy, and medicine. But by the mid-18th century, the Republic's science was fading and its universities were losing prestige and enrollment. Most of the difficulty had to do with the general ebb of the nation's industry and economy, which shrank educational outlays and funding of facilities. Even so, after the Orangist Revolution of 1747 to 1751, the ability of the Dutch Reformed Church to influence university appointments was a damper. The scientific side of the Dutch Enlightenment withered. The impact of British evangelicalism on science was largely cultural, not heavy-handed or political. Science, as opposed to industry and exports, was not much of a cause or priority in the last decades of the 19th century. The preoccupation of Britain's elite with moral imperialism, global finance, colonial administration, foreign missions, and the great game in India, Persia, and Central Asia, to say nothing of the glamour of the household cavalry, Bengal lancers, and the world's greatest navy, had shaped upper-tier education in a different vein. Its dominant preoccupations were with gentlemanly conduct, sportsmanship and playing fields, moral principles, religion, classics, history, Athens and Sparta, Locke and Blackstone, Drake and Wellington, not engines and test tubes. After Charles Darwin published his theories of evolution, many churchmen became prominent critics of scientific inquiry. At Rugby, the famous headmaster Matthew Arnold commented that, "Rather than have it, science, the principal thing in my son's mind, I would gladly have him think that the sun went around the earth and that the stars were so many spangles set in the bright blue firmament. Surely the one thing needed for a Christian and Englishman to study is a Christian and moral and political philosophy." Just as the Battle of Waterloo 100 years earlier had been won on the playing fields of Eton, the technological naivete writ large in initial British enthusiasm, coupled with unreadiness for World War I, had at least some connection to the sort of elite curriculum at Rugby. But as World War I lengthened without British success, the nation's lack of adequate scientific and technological preparation became a scandal. The stuff of irate speeches in Parliament and appalled acknowledgments by government commissions charged with investigation. In The Closing of the Western Mind, Freeman suggested that late Roman faith began to create the barrier between science and rational thought in general and religion that appears to be unique to Christianity. If so, perhaps latter-day evangelical Protestantism exemplifies this tendency, given how American sects of the 1920s and again in the early 21st century challenged the science of Charles Darwin in much the same way that so many religious Britons had during the Victorian years. A third common litmus test, the economic and social polarization and decay common to the late years of our four world powers, is probably their most commented upon characteristic. Brevity, then, seems in order, and readers interested in fuller detail will find some in Chapter 4 of my book, Wealth and Democracy, 2002. Rome's multifarious decay, in fact, has become a stereotype. a Hollywood drama of epicene emperors lolling on purple couches, stuffing and amusing themselves as the poor starved and Goths and Vandals crossed the Rubicon. But this characterization should not be mistaken for fantasy or fiction. The decay was real. Spain's decline has also become a caricature, especially in history books that quote the arbitrista reformers of the early 17th century. One of them, González de Sayarigo, summed up that Spain has come to be an extreme contrast of rich and poor, and there is no means of adjusting them one to another. Our condition is one in which we have rich who loll at ease, and poor who beg, and we lack people of the middling sort, whom neither wealth nor poverty prevents from pursuing the rightful kind of business enjoined by natural law. Most scholars cite his views. Spanish morale was dulled by desengaño, a national disillusionment, vast bureaucracy, upper-class luxury, immorality, and political corruption. These were targeted, without any notable success, by sumptuary decrees restricting attire, by curbs on prostitution, and by abolition of unnecessary government positions and receiverships. Then, as now, such reforms rarely succeed.